Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode of Excess Returns, Jack and I do round two of Show Us Your Portfolio with Larry Swedrow, prolific author of multiple investing books and head of financial and economic research at Buckingham Strategic Wealth. From investing in interval funds to a wide array of alternative assets, Larry walks us through his personal portfolio and his quest to have a highly diversified source of returns that can power his portfolio for the long run and produce desired outcomes in many different market environments. Larry takes a disciplined, evidence-based, and first principles approach that all investors can learn from. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Buckingham's Larry Swedrow. Hi, Larry. How are you? Thank you very much for joining us again.
Great to be back with you, Justin and Jack.
We sat down with you earlier this year, and you were kind enough to join us on one of our Show Us Your Portfolio episodes, and we were really interested in talking to you about your personal approach to investing. You kind of take an evidence-based approach, but then, you know, there's a lot of other asset classes. What we learned actually during that conversation, there's a lot of other asset classes and return streams that are sort of feeding into your portfolio. And in that discussion, as we sort of uncovered this with the way that you manage your portfolio, it was kind of funny. Like during the conversation, you were like, you know, if you guys want to explore that either now or in the future, we can do that. And then after we had a great 60-minute conversation, you know, Jack and I ended and we're like, okay, we got to have Larry back on to talk about all this other stuff we weren't able to talk about. So that's going to be great. And that's what we're going to tackle today.
Sounds good.
Before we get into some of that, though, we wanted to kind of just frame up the discussion, because I think where a lot of investors start with their personal portfolios is around stocks and bonds. So when you think about the performance of equities and the performance of fixed income, given where rates are today, and you think about the future long-term returns relative to maybe what the past 40 years of returns have been, let's say up until the end of 2021, how do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, first, I want to make clear here that you want to distinguish, I think, and you were distinguishing between public stocks and public bonds. And there are also equities and fixed income investments that can be private. Doesn't mean they're not equities or fixed income. They're just private. So we want to make that clear. The one good thing for investors, which has changed from when I last wrote my complete guide to a successful and secure retirement in 2020, was that rates were at zero and valuations were high. So that the expected return to stocks going forward were much lower than the historical 10% expected return. A good example that we might look at is the best predictor we have of future equity returns, or at least as good as any we have, is the earnings yield. Whether you take the CAPE 1 or the CAPE 10, doesn't make too much difference. They both have about roughly a 40% explanatory power. So the CAPE 10 was, my memory serves, was in around 30 or so. And so that gave you a 3% or so, or 3.3 expected real return, and expected inflation was, call it roughly 2. So you were expecting 5 or 5.5, something like that for equities, which was about half of the historical return. And bond yields were in the 1% kind of range. 1.5 maybe, and so versus maybe the 4 to 5 that they had gotten historically. So investors who were building traditional portfolios really had to make a tough adjustment if they were going to be realistic, and if they didn't, they were likely to underperform and not achieve their financial goals. Today, valuations for bonds certainly have come way up, and that's helped across the board for any balanced portfolio. Equity valuations are kind of bifurcated. And by that, I mean, if you look at the big market cap indices, which because they're market cap weighted and dominated by a few stocks, the top 10 in the S&P today account for 35%. That might be a record high. And so their valuations look high. Their market PE is, you know, something in the low 20s maybe today versus a lower historical number. But if you look at the rest of the market, international stocks are trading more at the 12 and 11 for emerging markets and developed, and small value stocks around the globe, at least for the funds of families that get deep factor exposure like Avantis does, you're talking in the sevens and eights, which is like a depression scenario. So those seven and eights are predicting much higher expected returns, reflecting what the market perceives as the risk in those areas. So you can't broadly make statements about equity valuations. You have to look at the various segments and see what your portfolio is exposed to when you forecast returns.
Yeah, that's a good point. And especially up through about a month ago, you know, the market was basically being led by that handful of large cap sort of high growth tech stocks that you're talking about. It's broadened out recently, but I mean, that is the one thing that, you know, was happening for most of this year is large caps doing awesome and everything else kind of being left behind.
Yeah. And I think it's worth noting that while what I'm about to say isn't the forecast, because my crystal ball is always cloudy, we can learn from history. And there's only been three other times that we've seen this kind of concentration and valuations. And each time that happened, the Nifty 50 was the first case. The dot-com boom around the end of the 90s. And now, in the other two cases, those high valuations crashed while the rest of the market didn't do anywhere near as poorly after that. So it's at least it's a warning to investors who have their portfolios concentrated and making bets, usually driven by some story. In this case, it's an AI story. They tend not to be fulfilled, and long-term expectation or reality tends to be less than the expectations, and valuations tend to come crashing down when those earnings don't get realized.
You gave me a good idea for my YouTube cover image. It's going to be a picture of you looking into a cloudy crystal ball. I'm just kidding. I'm just joking.
I'm always humble about making market forecasts. If anyone who isn't is a legend in their own mind, that's all.
Exactly. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, you talked, when we first talked to you about your personal portfolio, you had this idea of equally distributing risk. And I just thought before I hand it over to Jack to talk about some of these alternatives, sort of, if you could just explain how you actually think about that or do that in practice.
Yeah, this is really good starting point. I have what are basic called first principles, the things that matter most when you think about building portfolios. And they follow some pretty simple logic. And this is the way I think all investors should think. First of all of your principles should be based upon academic, evidence-based, peer-reviewed research. And the first thing we know is that while the markets are not perfectly efficient, there are lots of anomalies that go unexplained. Investors are best served by acting as if the market is highly efficient, using systematic, transparent, replicable strategies like index funds. But index funds have some negatives which can either be minimized or eliminated through intelligent design. So I use all strategies that are systematic, transparent, or replicable. I don't own a single index fund. So my starting point is you should be systematic, transparent, and replicable. Some people use the word passive to represent. I don't think that's descriptive enough. So I use those three words. If you believe markets are highly efficient, then it must follow that all risk assets have very similar risk-adjusted returns. Not similar returns, riskier assets, should have higher expected returns to compensate for that risk. And risk is not just volatility. It has to consider other things like how fat are the tails? What's the skewness and kurtosis, using the technical terms? In addition, you want to also look at things like liquidity. Neither of those two things are captured in things like Sharpe ratios. So people who need liquidity, you know, have to give up and can't earn an illiquidity premium. But for someone like the Yale Endowment, which spends, say, 5 or 6% of their endowment every year, they can load up on illiquid assets. And for them, that illiquidity premium is as close to a free lunch as you can get. I'll take the opportunity to point out that I've asked our over 100 advisors. We manage $26 billion ourselves, and collectively all the firms in the BAM community, there are over 1,000 advisors. I've asked them all. I've never heard one yet say, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, I've never heard one of our clients say they're taking more than their RMDs from their IRAs, which means even at age 90, you're not taking 10%. So most people vastly underinvest in illiquid assets because they're missing the opportunity. For whatever the reason, they think they need liquidity when the reality is they don't, at least for a significant portion of their portfolio. So if you believe that all risk assets have similar risk-adjusted returns, why would you concentrate your portfolio in any one factor or unique source of risk? And the typical 60-40 stock and bond portfolio has 85-90% of the risk in market beta, when we know there are lots of other sources of risk. So the Harvards and Yales of the world have been addressing this for decades by building more of what are called risk parity type portfolios. And while even our clients only typically hold 10 or 15% in alternatives, the Harvards and Yales own 50, 60%, and most individuals on close to zero. I think the number should be much closer to that of the Harvards and Yales, especially those clients who actually don't need a lot of liquidity. My own portfolio, I've been moving over the years up and up. I'm in the mid-40s now and probably moving a bit higher. And I've moved higher as private vehicles, which are less liquid, have become available that are much cheaper, if not cheap, and still, but they're much cheaper than the 2 and 20 fees that typically prevailed up until a few years ago. And so assets that I would have liked to invest in, but the management firms were capturing all the value, and so I didn't, unless you were Yale and Harvard and could negotiate much lower fees. But today that world has changed. And the fees, while not low compared to index funds or other systematic strategies, are now much lower, allowing you to capture a significant portion of that excess return.
We're going to talk about a variety of alternatives, you know, many of which investors probably may not have heard of or may not invest in. But first, I want to talk about your framework. When you're looking at these types of alternatives, what are the criteria you use to decide whether you might want to invest in it?
Great question. I highly recommend your listeners pick up a copy of what I think is the seminal book on factor investing that Andy Berkin and I wrote, Your Complete Guide to Factor-Based Investing. And in that book, I'm really proud, we established 5 criteria that were required in addition to showing evidence of a premium that a factor or a investment strategy had to meet all of them before you consider an investment. And that can apply to other investments, not just factors. So those criteria were the premium, and it had to show evidence that it was persistent across very long periods of time. So it wasn't just a lucky good period of good economic times. It had to be pervasive around the globe across industries, sectors, countries and regions, as well as, of course, asset classes, if that was appropriate. It had to be robust to various definitions. So value works whether you look at price to earnings, cash flow, EBITDA to enterprise value. Momentum works whether you use 30, 60, 90, 120 days, et cetera. It had to have intuitive risk-based or behavioral explanations for why you think the premium will persist. Now, important to recognize, I greatly prefer risk-based explanations because they cannot be arbitraged away. Can't arbitrage away the excess risk of stocks versus T-bills, right? Now, the premium to stocks can go up or down depending on how optimistic and pessimistic investors are, but it should never be arbed away. Behavioral explanations can be arbed away, but we do know that there are some significant limits to arbitrage, including the high risk and costs of shorting. So if you can recognize these limitations to arbitrage, then you can consider it. And lastly, they have to survive transactions costs. So if the size premium, for argument's sake, looking at microcap stocks was 4%, but it costs you 5% to trade it, it doesn't do you any good at all. So what I do is, one, any investment must meet all those criteria, but some I have stronger evidence than others. So I feel more confident. I will not use an equal weighting or risk parity strategy. I will put more weight on that factor or strategy. And I have more confidence in risk-based strategies than behavioral ones. So, for example, I will put more weight and more of my assets in value strategies than I will in momentum. But every fund I invest in on the equity side incorporates some momentum strategies in their construction rules. So that's how I think about it. Whether it's reinsurance or life settlements, it doesn't matter. It has to meet all that criteria.
Many of the things we're going to talk about today, or at least some of them, are going to be available through what's called an interval fund, which I think is a pretty new vehicle in terms of being available to investors. So before we talk about them, I just want to talk about that structure in general. Like, what is an interval fund and how does it work?
Yeah, that's an important question, because that innovation when the SEC allowed interval funds really opened up asset classes that would not be available to investors otherwise. First of all, an interval fund, just to set the record straight, cannot be owned in 401k retirement plans, those types of things. You have to have daily liquid investments like stocks and treasuries and corporate bonds, publicly available securities that are highly liquid, of course. So an interval fund, what it does is it holds assets that are not perfectly liquid, but the SEC requires them to be able to make a minimum of 5% withdrawals every quarter. So that could get you 20% a year. So to keep that liquidity, they typically will own some portion of highly liquid assets, whether it's treasury bills or even high yield corporate bonds. If it's a private credit fund, they could do that. They can use credit lines to help meet those requirements. And so just so investors could understand, let's say you put $1 million into an interval fund, and it's got $1 billion, okay, of assets. 5% would be 50 million. If you're the only one who requests your $1 million redemption you want entirely out, no one else requests out, you get your full million. If more than 50 million was requested, you would get a pro rata share, as would everybody else, unless the fund decided it could meet and was willing to, as Stoneridge did with its reinsurance fund, it paid out more than it was required to. So by enabling funds to hold assets that weren't liquid, and enabled investors to invest in these less liquid asset classes like private credit, like reinsurance, like life settlements, other things. So I'll give you one good example to help people think. So this is just a concept idea. So Jack, let's say you have an opportunity to invest in one of two assets. Okay, so think of, you know, Citicorp, let's just use them as a bank, and it's got a big credit card business. The credit cards are yielding 20%. They expect 9% losses, not guaranteed, of course. It could be much worse or much better. And it costs them 1% to service it. So their expected return is 10%. Now, let's say in theory, you could buy that asset. Alternatively, now Justin comes along and he says, I want to take a new credit card out and borrow. But the chief financial officer says, we don't have any more capital to set aside. We can't do that business with Justin. Now Justin's going to pull his corporate business and everything else. They want to service him. So what do? They take a portion of their assets, go to the capital market, securitize it, and turn it into what's called an asset-backed security, or ABS. It gets rated by Moody's, and portions of it will be AAA and, you know, et cetera. And sliced and diced, and, you know, and now it's daily liquid. Now, because it's daily liquid, the market says we only require a 7.5% yield. Now, you're sitting with your money and you're not near your retirement date. You have absolutely no plans to take money out of your IRA, and you have other liquid assets you could get reach in an emergency, some safe bonds in your portfolio. Would you rather own the 7.5% illiquid investment with exactly the same interest rate risk and credit risk, or the 10%?
You'd probably want to own the 10%, I would guess.
Not probably. Yeah, I mean, it's a no-brainer. Now, you have to meet that criteria, right? Now, so that's basically another good example is reinsurance. You can't have reinsurance in a daily liquid fund, at least in what are called quota shares, where you're buying a book of the insurer's business or reinsurers, because you've signed the contract to take that risk, right, for a full year. So you say 3 months after you invested in it, you want your money back. Well, too bad, that contract is out there. So you give up that liquidity for a year. But Stoneridge says, all right, we'll buy these contracts and we'll hold, say, 5% or 10% in either cash, borrowing credit lines from banks, or it might even own a cat bond, which is daily liquid, but that's highly concentrated in U.S. hurricane risk, where the quota shares can have global risk in earthquake, hurricane, wind, all kinds of other risks, much more diversified. Guess which one yields more? Well, the one that's illiquid, because people like liquidity. And if you need liquidity, you own the daily liquid asset. If you don't need it, you can capture those large illiquidity premiums, which tend to be in the range of, call it 1.5% to 3% or more, depending upon how illiquid it is. So like a rubber plantation in Indonesia is going to be highly illiquid and should have a huge premium there. And that's why the Harvards and Yales of the world invest in those kinds of things.
So the idea in terms of preventing like a cascade where, you know, everybody pulls their money and suddenly the illiquid assets have to be sold is that 5% limit you were talking about before. So you can't, everybody can't run for the door at the same time. It's got to be spread out over periods of time.
Yeah. So you have to have conviction and a faith and a belief that the premium will last for a long time. The strategy is good. You have to really do your due diligence on the fund manager to make sure their trustworthy, long record of performance, all of those things. Of course, it's possible you may need 5 years to get out entirely of your investment. And that's what scares a lot of people. But in my opinion, it should not. If you're either able to do that due diligence on your own, or you have a trusted advisor who could do that for you. But you have to make sure that that investment meets all of those criteria that I laid out to give you the confidence to make that investment. And then you need the discipline to stay the course.
So I want to work through some of these individually, because these are all really interesting and many people may not have heard of these. So when I list each one, can you just talk about like what the return profile is, what you think the investment case is for each one of these? And the first one is private credit.
Right. Okay. So you have public credits, investment grade assets. Okay. And then you have private credits, which tended to be a relatively smaller part of the market up until the great financial crisis, mostly smaller, maybe mid-sized companies, and the bank serviced, you know, even those markets very well. The great financial crisis caused banks who needed to desperately raise capital, pull back, and private credit stepped in. Now, private credit raises capital from investors like you and I and the Harvards and Yales of the world, and they make loans directly to those companies. And they can act much faster, typically, than banks, which go through big committees. It could take months and months to get approval. Private credit tends to react much quicker. And private credit, if done properly, actually has a far superior credit history to public credits of similar background. So mid-sized companies, 150, 200 million EBITDA. If you look at, for example, Vanguard's high yield fund, last time I looked, it was yielding about 8.5%. It's got something like a 6 or 7 year maturity. Now, the Cliffwater Interval Fund, their private credit fund, which is CCLFX, it's all floating rate debt. And that's something I wanted to avoid, was maturity risk when yields were so low, because I thought the risks were, you know, asymmetric. Rates were not likely to go down much, but they could go up a lot. And Cliffwater's fund is much safer than Vanguard's high yield fund and credit, because it's very specific to the debt is all senior secured. There is no covenants that are often there in public credits, and it's sponsored by leading private equity firms who will often step in if there's problems, because if they don't step in to provide more equity and renegotiate a deal, guess what? They get wiped out totally. So it's not a guarantee, of course, they'll step in if something's in dire need and they can't see a way out. But these are companies that typically make long investments. So Cliffwater has an index of these types of credits that are senior and secured that goes back to, I think, now 20 years. The historical defaults are 1%. Losses, 1%.
Well, okay.
Cliffwater adds that it also has to be backed by private equity. That database isn't quite as long, but it does have a better credit history, as you would expect, because the private equity firms have done their due diligence too and are prepared to, they know it's possible they could have to put more. Their credit experience is 25 basis points in credit losses. Now, today, that fund has a net yield of about 11.5 or about 3% more, with no term risk, which you should be compensated for, right, for taking, superior credit profile. In March of 2020, the fund lost 3%, where high yield debt got slaughtered. Why would you own the Vanguard High Yield Fund, which has tens of billions in it, over this fund? It's because it's illiquid. It carries that much larger premium. There are other well-run vehicles, firms with 15, 20-year track records of, you know, strong performance as well. So that's one example where you can access private credit. Now, I will say these are not generally available interval funds to the general public. Most of these firms know that this is a limited capacity area. They don't want to deal with the general public directly because of all the education about interval funds and the flights that naive retail investors tend to engage in. So they tend to work with, in some cases, even a relatively small number of advisors. Stoneridge, for example, I think it's less than 100. Cliffwater somewhere maybe in that range. So you have to work with an advisor who does have access.
This next one's really interesting because I know absolutely nothing about it. Can you talk about structured life settlements?
Yeah, this is, to me, as natural, simple explanation as there is, right? We know that life insurance companies, right, they make investments in policies with an expected return on their capital, right? So now, Jack, let's say, you know, just using as an example, you bought a policy and you've been paying premiums for 30 years and something unfortunately happens bad health-wise to you. You can't make your premiums anymore. The insurance companies love you because what happens is now you're going to take your policy, cancel it, so you can, because you can't pay the premiums anymore, and use it to pay your medical bills. A very, very small percentage of life insurance policies ever pay off. Many of them don't pay off for reasons that I just gave you. Now, if you're able to pay the premiums, great, then you get paid off, and the insurance company didn't probably get their expected return. You died earlier. But that wasn't the case until fairly recently. Now, the regulations in, I think, almost all states, if not all, require the insurance company to tell you that you can sell that policy. Now you see ads on TV all the time from firms like Coventry and others that they're willing to buy your policy from you, giving you the cash. You now get to pay your medical bills, you know, maybe live in your home and dig with dignity and those things. And there's obviously going to be an expected return. The buyer of the policy is buying an illiquid asset. They don't know when you're going to die. They can only estimate it based upon a doctor's report, which is what a good firm will do. They'll have a doctor who specializes in that disease to estimate, look at the x-rays or MRIs or whatever, and say the expected life expectancy is 3 years. And then you can make a price based on that. The expected returns to these go up and down. They were in the mid to high single digits before the great financial crisis. Then liquidity became a big issue. They jumped into the high teens and the big hedge funds. Many of them played there. And now they come down into the low double digits in the 10 to 12% range. And it's like the perfect asset because it's obviously totally uncorrelated to stocks and bonds and anything else, has a relatively high expected return. And you're helping people because you're enabling them to get the cash they need. And otherwise they'd have to let the policy expire. The same thing applies to other structured settlements. Say, Jack, your parents, if they're alive, someone gets injured in a car accident and they get a settlement as an annuity of $100,000 a year, but they want the cash now. Okay, I'll step in and buy that for you at a discount rate. And I don't know how long you're going to live to get that either. So I'm going to provide a risk premium over that. And so firms can not only combine life settlements, but other structured settlements. And similarly, there are other assets, same things can apply, things like drug royalties, music royalties. You can invest in those. And Cliffwater has a fund that is called their Extended Credit Fund that invests in things like that as well.
I'm just curious, before we get to the next one, I mean, do you think this is something, you mentioned this is only available through select advisors, a lot of this stuff. Do you think this is something that could become available like to the investing public at some point? Or are there too many issues like behaviorally with people panicking and stuff that they just wouldn't want to do that?
Anything's possible. As we said, my crystal ball is always cloudy, but these are really limited capacity areas. And so the big guys like Vanguard, one, are almost certainly not going to play in that space, who would make it available. Maybe they've got the staff and would do it. And so these companies don't want to have big staff to accommodate working with the public, 800 lines and, you know, things like that, and the expense and marketing to them. So that's one. And they don't want the behavioral issues as well.
So the next one's another one I know very little about, and that's drug royalties. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So you're now an inventor and you've invented a new drug, spent decades of being poor while you try to, you know, develop the product. And now along comes Pfizer and says, we'll buy your drug and we'll pay you, you know, 6% royalties on this for the next 30 years or whatever, you know, the life of the patent, whatever. And so you say, great, but I want to move on and do my next drug and I don't have the cash. I can't wait. So I'll go and sell that to an investment firm and they'll pay you up front a specified amount based upon their estimates of what the sales, et cetera, will be. So it's exactly like a settlement in a lawsuit where someone was hurt in a car crash. Only here you're now having to make estimates instead of known amounts. So that's an example, litigation finance. So Jack, you're a lawyer and you want to pursue a case, but you don't have the money to fund it. People will come in and say, all right, we'll fund that in return for X percent of those proceeds. So you could do things like that. Obviously, that cannot be a daily liquid fund, which would make it available to the general public. And trying to explain all the complexity to the average person, I just don't see it as likely.
The next one's interesting because pretty much everybody pursues factor investing on a long-only basis, or, you know, that's where the vast majority of the assets are. But you do it in a different way here, at least for this portion of your portfolio. You invest in these long-short factor funds. So can you talk about why you do it that way and how you think about that in the context of your portfolio?
Yeah, here is an example of one that is a daily liquid, so you don't need an interval fund. I invest in AQR's style premium fund. The symbol is QSPIX for tax advantaged accounts and QSPRX for tax advantaged taxable accounts. It just avoids commodities, which would make it more tax inefficient. Most people who invest in factors like value and size and profitability buy stocks that have those characteristics, but they don't go short the other side of the trade. So it's not a market neutral. You're also long market beta, right? So in order to diversify the portfolio more, you can go long short, and now you have pure 100% exposure to the factor. And not only that, but in AQR's case, for example, with value, it's long short. So it's long value, short growth, or long cheap and short expensive, depending on the asset class, stocks, bonds, commodities, and currencies. So I'm picking up unique exposures that have often nothing to do, that are uncorrelated with what's going on with market beta, which dominates most portfolios. So that fund is long, short, value, momentum, defensive, or you could think of it as quality and carry, factors that meet all of those criteria. They're ones that Andy Birkin and I put in our book. Out of the hundreds of factors in the factor zoo, we identified only 8 that we thought investors should consider. And those are 4 of the 8. And so I like that fund because it's totally uncorrelated.
How about just one more before we move on to some other questions? I want to ask you about reinsurance. How do you think about that?
Yeah, to me, this is another obvious no-brainer type of investment. We know the reinsurance business has been around for about 170 years. You know, obviously it's generated good profits, return on equity for the reinsurers who buy risks from other insurers who don't want too much risk in one particular area. Well, they have the same problem. They want to service their insurance clients and they don't have an unlimited supply of capital. So how, when, you know, State Farm, for example, goes to Swiss Re and says, I want to pass on some more hurricane risk in Florida, they don't want to turn them down because they may already have enough of that risk or don't have any more capital. They want to keep that relationship. So they raise capital and sell off some of that risk. Okay, that's what cat bonds do. They're daily liquid, but they're concentrated in hurricane risk. They tend to have premiums over the risk-free rate, depending upon how much risk there's been and how the losses have turned out recently. So obviously, stocks going up or down have nothing to do with the risk of hurricanes or earthquakes or tornadoes or windstorms or all this other stuff. Windstorms don't cause bear markets, etc. So it's a great asset in that it has no correlation to either stocks or bonds. And it's got a big risk premium that's persistent, pervasive, etc. You're just buying, in Stoneridge's case, it might be example, they go to, let's just use the name Swiss Reinsurance, and we'll say, so you can't cherry pick. I want to be your strategic partner. I'm going to buy 5% of all of your risks. So we know Swiss Re has been in business 170 years, great track record long term. They, like everything else, they go through periods of poor performance. That's the nature, or there wouldn't be risk premiums that would be large, right? So you live with that risk, but those losses should be uncorrelated with the other loss. And you partner with them, and now you've got a portion of their book of business. And you should earn very similar returns to what they earn on those risks. Now, the reinsurance companies, I don't want to own their stocks, even though I like that risk, because why don't I want to own their stocks? It's because what are the risks that are on their balance sheet? They take those premiums and invest it in stocks and bonds and real estate, which I already have on my balance sheet. I don't want to duplicate it. So in 2022, for example, when reinsurance had a decent year, reinsurance stocks got crushed because their stocks and bonds and real estate assets got crushed, right? So I can isolate that risk by buying these quota shares or cat bonds. And now I've got the right asset there. And so that's why I like it. I will tell a very brief story. Reinsurance, the first few years that Stoneridge came out with the product, had good returns. And then the next 3 years were pretty bad. Double digits or close to that. They're not, you know, 20% or more, but, you know, minus 12, minus 17, minus 5. So. And that fund, which at its peak had $5 billion of assets, saw the typical naive, even with advisors help holding their hands, drop down to $1 billion. Now, some of that, of course, was caused by a roughly downdraft of high 20%, obviously. But much of it was caused by people withdrawing. Well, last year, the fund was up about 6%, and this year it's up 43%.
Wow.
So, you know, unfortunately, 80% of those investors or 70 didn't earn those returns because they didn't. Now, those the same type of people, maybe that bail out of stocks after two or three bad years. But we see this pattern that while they may not bail out of stocks because they understand it more, okay, or think they do, right? They will bail out of reinsurance or drug royalties or private credit. They just chase returns and think it was a bad idea when the logic is perfectly there. And good example, Warren Buffett loaded up on reinsurance at the start of 2023 because he saw, guess what? After bad years, the premiums go way up. The underwriting standards go way up. So if you want hurricane insurance in Florida, it better be steel reinforced concrete, not, wood-based house. And if you want fire insurance in California, you can't have a tree within 30 feet of the house and 30 feet of the next tree and 30 more feet of brush that's cleared. And by the way, the deductibles went way up. So the risk is actually down. The premiums are way up, and yet people flee. That's partly why a lot of these firms will not take retail investor money.
No, that makes a lot of sense. What I really like about these is, you know, going back to your criteria at the beginning, like I always like to ask myself when I'm investing in anything, why am I getting paid to do this? And like all of these, as you've gone through them, they have compelling reasons why you should get paid to do it. And so if you expect it to persist in the future, I mean, that's a good reason for it to persist in the future. There's a good explanation in all these cases why you should make money by doing these things.
Yeah, and exactly. And by the way, that's why you don't overweight anything. I mean, to me, the expected return to the reinsurance fund this year, this fund SRRIX, was in the low to mid 20s. Turned out to be a much better year than expected. We didn't have any big hurricane or earthquake losses. There were some losses, but not a lot. So the losses were less. And last year, the fund, the reinsurers, vastly overestimated the losses from one of the hurricanes. So the fund reported losses of minus 5.5. But this year, big gains, about 10%, were related to reversing last year's estimated losses. But, you know, when you get a hurricane in October, you don't know what the payout will be till maybe the following year, at the end of the year, like now, or maybe even a bit longer. So you make estimates. Now, randomly, it'll be higher or lower than you expect. Turned out to be, they estimated too conservatively. And so this last year was about minus 5.5, this year up about 43.5. If they had guessed right, last year would have been up about 16 and this year 33. Right? Now, I saw that high expected return, so I added significantly to my portfolio exposure to the fund, but I still only own like 3 to 5%. I don't remember the exact number. I spread my risk out across many different assets.
Just one more for me before I hand it back to Justin. I want to ask you about something that a lot of people are starting to invest more in now, particularly as it becomes accessible through ETFs and, you know, more readily available for your average investor, which is managed futures. What are your views on managed futures? Do you use them in your portfolio? And what do you think about them in general?
Yeah. So here's the thing. Managed futures, which generally you think of as trend following, right? So momentum, but specifically time series momentum or trend following. You buy what's going up and you sell what's going down, all right? That was one of the factors that Andy Birkin and I in our book on factor investing identified, met all the criteria. However, as I said earlier, there is no risk-based possible explanation, although people have tried to concoct them after the fact. But it is purely behavioral-based. But the evidence is strong, so I don't ignore it. And as I said, every one of the equity funds that I invest in includes exposure to momentum. So, for example, a value fund often will buy stocks that is falling in price. It was a growth stock, now got cheap and is now value, it will buy it. Well, the funds I own won't buy it even though it meets the criteria if it has negative momentum. It'll stop buying or wait until that negative momentum ceases. And when it starts to go up and is no longer, maybe they have a cap at PE, I'll make this up, of 15, the PE goes above 15, they may hold it for a while longer until they see that negative momentum decline, at least maybe until the PE gets to 17. I'm just making up examples there. And the fund I own, I mentioned earlier, AQR Style Premium, is in momentum also as well. I did at one point in my life cycle of investing have a trend following fund, AQR's fund, which meets all the criteria. But then over the years, there started to become available funds that met my criteria, the much stronger risk-based explanations. So the outlook, and I think a much higher expected future return. Okay. And therefore, I dropped that and added exposure to these other asset classes, which I believe provide, you know, some good tail risk protection as well, and have more logical risk-based explanations and higher expected returns. So I have no problem with someone including a trend-following strategy in their portfolio, but they should recognize they should never be buying it to enhance returns. It should be bought to protect tail risk because it tends to do best when it's needed most in long periods of underperformance, right? Like 73.4, 2002, 08, you know, lasted quite a while. But most of the time, because markets go up, you're going to be trailing. Right. So don't expect it to do well. In fact, it could go a decade, as it has done, when it does poorly. And then in 1 year, it makes up for all of that. And you're thankful you owned it. But only if you stayed the decade through poor returns. Most individual investors can't do that, sadly. And so they miss out. So if you can't do that, then you should never buy it in the first place.
Just one personal story for me, and then there's a question on the backside of this, but I was always one of those people that like highly valued liquidity. So that's just how I kind of manage my investments. And then Jack and I both have a good friend who had done really well in real estate outside of the area where we live. We live in Connecticut. He had done really well with commercial real estate and private real estate and multifamily in Texas. But then they came up here and they identified a pretty decent size commercial deal that I ended up investing in. But the only way I was able to get comfortable with that illiquidity was I had to kind of see the asset. Like I had to sort of know what I was investing in because I knew the money was going to be locked up. And they were honest with me and they said, hey, listen, this is going to be, you know, a 5 to 10 year investment. Distributions might not start right away. You know, I earmarked whatever portion of my portfolio, a small, you know, portion of my portfolio and invested in that. And that has probably been, I'd say, the most successful investment I've ever made. But so that's the story. But the question is, how do you advise advisors or how do you think investors should think about getting over this illiquidity thing? Because I was able to see the asset. I was able to go and touch it and know what I was investing in when a lot of investors sort of might not be able to do that. So what would be some strategies that you would advise people do for that?
Well, the first thing, you should never invest in something you don't understand the nature of the risk, unless you just have blind faith in your advisor that, hey, I've worked with them for 20 years. They know far more than me. I don't know anything about this stuff, but I know, you know, tell me the story. And if it makes logical sense, anyone can understand the example, Jack, I gave you on the credit card debt, for example. Or private credit. Here's the data. I've written 15-page papers on reinsurance and private credit. Look at the evidence. You should demand to see the empirical research, the evidence, the data. You should do your due diligence. See if the story makes intuitive common sense, which, Jack, you said, yeah, all these things do, right? You don't have to see something. In fact, Justin, that's actually, to some degree, a bad idea because, and here's the reason why, because if you become familiar with something, you think it's safer. So a great example I'll give you is, guess what stock people in Atlanta own a disproportionate share of?
Probably Home Depot or maybe Coke.
Coke, right?
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
To own Coke, Justin? If you live where you live or if you live in Atlanta.
Yeah, no. We all have that bias of, right.
But there are lots of people who are employed there. They live there. They work there. Now, what if you worked at Enron and you lived in Houston? You know, you load up.
Yeah,
you're familiar. I work at the guy. I know all this stuff, right? Familiarity breeds overconfidence. That should not be a criteria. Now, all it's doing is checking out to make sure that building exists. These guys are real. yeah, you can look at it, but it's much more important to understand the story there. And in every case that I've told you, and this is really important, I'm glad we got to this story, actually. Whenever I invest, I avoid idiosyncratic risk. I only want to own the beta of that asset class. So StoneRidge doesn't, unlike some hedge funds in reinsurance, hedge funds will go in and say, now I like Florida hurricane risk because the premiums went way up. I don't like California earthquake risk. I like this, not that. StoneRidge says, I want the beta of the asset class. They go to 8 or 10 or whatever number of, you know, highly regarded institutional players, and they buy these quota shares. I own thousands of different risks, or hundreds of different risks across broad regions of the world, different perils. The same thing is true of Cliffwater. They buy from 10 different industries, the best managers who have long track records, credit. And when they make a $200 million loan, Cliffwater takes $2 million of it. They've got, I don't know, $15 billion and 15,000 loans. One loan goes bad, it's not, you know, there's no impact on them. You never want to make that one single building investment, in my opinion. You know, that's taking huge idiosyncratic risk. If I want to invest in private credit, I do it through Blackstone, which has a BREIT product, which has outperformed the public markets by about 3% a year since inception, because you're getting an illiquidity premium. Pretty simple. But it's highly diversified. So key, understand, do your due diligence, read, learn, make sure it makes intuitive sense.
Jeez, I'm going to have you on speed dial the next time I'm presented with one of those deals to make sure I don't do anything bad. That one worked out, but I think those are all, you know, fair points.
And that's the problem.
Absolutely.
That's the problem. That works out. Then you think the next one will work out. And, you know,
right. Exactly.
He's locked with a smart strategy, right?
I guess, and it's sort of, it's not really along the same lines, but, you know, when investors incorporate some of these alternative investments, inevitably there'll be years where some of these will really be doing what they're supposed to be doing. There'll be years where maybe they'll be a little bit lackluster. And then, you know, many investors will turn around and compare their portfolios to a 60-40 or maybe just a long-only S&P 500 and say, wait a minute, you know, these things have detracted from returns. And there's that behavioral tendency to want to, you know, abandon ship and go where everyone else is making money. So, I mean, how do you just think that investors should give themselves the best chance for success in investing in these types of things?
Yeah, that's unfortunately a completely illogical way of thinking about it, although it's done by most investors. They don't know it's illogical, but let's start with the premise. Why are we buying these assets? What's the reason to consider them? Either Jack or Justin, you want to answer that?
Yeah, I mean, they're different. They're totally different return streams. I think they're going to diversify you. They're going to hopefully help limit risk when those assets come out.
Exactly right. If they're totally unique, then you can't and shouldn't ever compare. You're buying it because you fully expect that they will look different. And you actually hope that's the case. Now, that means you have to accept there will be some years, maybe even a long period, where that particular one will do poorly. But the S&P has underperformed T-bills for as long as 17 years. Do you not buy stocks because of that? You know, from 29 to 43, 66 to 83, and 2012, that's 45 years. That's almost half of the life of the markets. Now, the other times it greatly outperforms and it's earned a big premium. Well, the same thing must be true of all these other assets, or you wouldn't get the premium. So the key is what that means is you want to diversify. You must accept this tracking variance to reduce the volatility of your portfolio, which is the objective. And the only way to do that is to add these low correlating assets. So you then can't compare it and complain when you got exactly what you wanted. These funds are always doing what they're supposed to be doing. It's just that sometimes you like the results, sometimes you don't. And the worst mistake that people make is they engage in what's called resulting. They judge the performance of a strategy by the outcome and not by the quality of the decision before you know the outcome, which you shouldn't do because we don't have clear crystal balls. It's like after, you know, Russell Wilson threw that interception for the Seattle Seahawks, when everyone thought they should have been running the ball, they said that was a bad decision. Well, the sabermeticians went and looked at it and analyzed it and found it was exactly the right call to make from a statistical perspective, because Lynch, Marshawn Lynch, the great running back, had fumbled three times, if my memory serves, in that situation during the season. And Russell Wilson had never thrown an interception in that zone area the entire year. So it was much more likely to be successful. The other team just made a great play, but people said it was a dumb decision. He was, the fans tried to get him fired. The same thing is true here. You cannot judge things by the outcome, but only by the quality of your decisions, or you will be always chasing returns. You'll buy after periods of good performance when returns expected are low because prices are high and therefore premiums are low. And you want to not sell after bad periods because markets are self-healing. When bear markets happen, valuations come crashing down and expected returns are now higher. That's when, like Warren Buffett said, you know, don't time the market, but buy when everyone else is panicked and sell when everyone else is greedy. Same thing was true with reinsurance, which had three bad years. Big deal, right? Now it's had great years and you're gone and you never earn those returns. You have to be able to stay the course. And the only way to do that is to understand why you did it in the first place, write it down and sign it and say, I'm going to stick with it. Signed it in blood.
One last question here, and it's kind of a hard pivot off of the core of this discussion, but we wanted to ask you this. And I think, you know, because you've seen many different markets, a lot of different innovation in the investment industry over time. And I'm just curious, from your vantage point, where do you think a lot of the innovation is going to come from in the future? And we talked about the crystal ball. I'm not asking for any hardcore predictions, but I'm thinking things like direct indexing. You know, you're seeing more platforms that are getting investors access to private investing opportunities, sort of decentralization of real estate, slices of assets. You have like Masterworks and investing in art now. And so you're seeing technology is sort of, you know, bringing a lot of these opportunities to investors, but I'm just interested from your viewpoint, where do you think things are going to get very interesting here?
Yeah, I think exactly what you said. The interval fund structure has changed the nature of the game. Also, the big private equity firms have recognized that private equity with the capital call structure. So you commit $1 million and then you don't know when they're going to call 50,000 or 200, so you've got to keep liquid, really doesn't work well. And so they're moving to create something similar to an interval fund, although it won't be public. It'll be an evergreen fund, and you put your money in any time, once a month. You can make an investment. Maybe it's between the 20th and 25th of the month. And then they have a redemption feature, like monthly you can get out 2% a month or 5% a quarter, whichever is the lower of those numbers, like BREIT has today. That's Blackstone's real estate fund. You're going to see many more illiquid assets being liquidized, at least partially, through these interval fund structures to allow individual investors to invest in the same vehicles that the big institutional players and hedge funds have been doing for decades, and that's bringing prices down. So I think you're going to continue to see prices coming way down relative. I never invested in any transaction that had a 2 and 20, you know, kind of structure. Today, you're seeing deals, I've done some recently, that were 1% and 10%. A 10% carry. And I've seen some deals that were even less than that. interval funds with fees as low as roughly 1% as well, without any hurdles and no incentive fees. So I think you're going to see a lot more of that as well.
Larry, always super solid, always objective, thoughtful, and we really appreciate you coming on with us and sharing your wisdom with our audience. And happy holidays to you and your family. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Justin and Jack. Glad to be a help. Hopefully we can help get investors more comfortable so they can add these other assets to their portfolio. And in my book, Reducing the Risk of Black Swans, which I urge them all to read, we show how adding these alternatives greatly improves your odds of success. You run Monte Carlo simulations, you'll see the odds of not running out of money go way up because of those low correlations. It reduces the potential dispersion of outcomes. Best example I can give you, in 2022, every single one of my alternatives was up while stocks and bonds both got crushed in double-digit losses. So my portfolio net was only down, or it was about flat. It's actually, it was up slightly, where most people had severe losses, and maybe many of that caused many of them to panic and sell because they were afraid that the market could get a lot worse. I think it actually helps you stay the course because your portfolio volatility will go down, and that's key to avoiding sequence risk.
Thank you, Larry.
Take care.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.